are going to be discussing a couple of budgets that are on the expedited list this afternoon. And so why don't we just go ahead and get started if Susan Isaacs could come forward.
Yes, thank you. Would you like me to go ahead and begin?
Please.
I am Susan Isaacs. I am the Executive Director of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. The commission is a statutory creature, and it came into existence in 1968. We have our enabling statutes, and then everything comes from them, our rules of procedure and whatnot. The commission meets 6 times a year for regular meetings, but then, of course, if there are any prosecutions and hearings, then it would meet for those. We have all volunteers. It's 3 attorneys who are appointed by the Board of Governors, 3 judges who are appointed by our Chief Justice, and then we have 3 public members who are appointed by the Governor and then confirmed by the Senate. The job of the Commission is to investigate and review complaints about violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct and the applicable constitutional provisions for judges in this state to determine whether or not they have violated them. And if so, then there would be a prosecution. If you are at all familiar with the Oregon State Bar, essentially it has the same function for judges that the bar has for prosecuting lawyers, and we report to the Supreme Court. The commission itself has no authority to impose any type of discipline or sanction. Only the Supreme Court has that authority, so we report to them. I am the only employee. It's a part-time position, 0.5 FTE, and has always been, to my knowledge. At one point, there was a budgeted position for 0.25 clerical assistant, but that was done away with a few bienniums ago. So I am the only one. I have presented a handout, I think, that gives you a lot of information about the commission, the types of cases, how to file a complaint. We've discussed the 4 mandatory points on pages 3 and 4. The key budget drivers would, of course, be personnel as the major financial consideration. But what we don't know is how much a prosecution would cost. Now, with complaints, you do not know if you're going to have one that warrants a prosecution. It's completely unpredictable. So there's no way we could say we are going to prosecute a certain number per year, because it's strictly driven by whether or not there's merit. We had to go to the e-board for more money to cover this biennium because of some prosecutions that were going on, but had not been to the e-board since 1999, and I was very proud that during my tenure, I started in November 2000, we'd never had to come to the e-board. We'd always been able to maintain within the budget, but we have had to do that, and it simply happened because we had one that the commission felt had merit. So that's something that we find is very unpredictable. Mr. Borden and I have spent some time talking about the performance measures. A lot of the measures that we currently have measure my dissemination of information and being responsive to inquiries. And Mr. Borden and I have been talking about ways to have it focus more on the commission. The one that does currently focus on the commission is their ability to get a prosecution done from their initial review until they make their recommendations to the Supreme Court, and then any time after that, of course, would be the Supreme Court's time. But now he and I have put together some ideas, and I understand we'll speak to them later. We only have one program, so that's our priority. No policy packages, and for efficiency, we do a lot of group emails when we need immediate answers. It's in terms of money, it's much cheaper than having to put together conference calls, because we have determined that conference calls almost cost as much as actually having a meeting when we added up the cost of everybody calling in, as opposed to just doing the mileage and whatnot. So we found that doing email is really a good way to do it. Do you have any questions for me?
How many judges in the last, like in the last year, were actually prosecuted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, we had a prosecution in September. It went for 2 days. The fall before that, we had a prosecution in Medford. So, and that was why part of what was driven for this biennium. We have actually also had some stipulated decisions. We have that ability for the commission if it's approved by the Supreme Court. So that, of course, is cheaper, but it's still some prosecutions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Nicholson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have time to explore a couple of detail points about the use of technology?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm pleased that you're able to use technology to get work accomplished within a responsible time and budget and so forth. So my questions are, first of all, I'm concerned that conference calls are expensive. Do you know, what can you tell me about either within your own agency or within state government, what's being done to address the high cost of teleconferencing or even video conferencing? It's counterintuitive. I think the public would assume that it's cheap to do teleconferencing or video conferencing, and it's actually not. Is there something that we can do to help make this a more affordable solution and alternative to meeting in person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I can't speak to anything other than my agency, but what I will tell you is that we do not conference call very much. I think when we put together the figures and determined that it's not really that cost effective, we went more to the group email, and I will tell the commission members, please respond in the header part, you know, that comes up, and so that they know that this isn't just information, this is one, please reply to me. Mm-hmm. We haven't had the need to do much in the way of the conference calls for a couple years, I would say. At times they were used if there was something urgent that needed to come up between meetings, mm-hmm. but I've pretty much managed to use the group email. We even have edited group decisions through email transactions.
And so you're finding that using email rather than, for example, a blog technology is still satisfactory, that people feel like it's a discussion rather than just one-way communication?
I haven't had any complaints. I don't think I am not that familiar with the blog discussion, and my assistant is quite young, and so she's very, very into the use of the computer and the internet. I think that the group that we have, we all are starting to sport a little gray hairs, and so we don't automatically think about blogging. We all use email, but I think that we interact in that way, and we wouldn't automatically think about like a instant messaging or something like that.
Or it feels more like a discussion. I guess what I'm getting at is sometimes a discussion where you can hear the tone of voice or see the body language, it's a little easier to understand whether someone was saying something in jest or serious, or how important a particular understanding the nuances of the mm-hmm. discussion to lead to an appropriate conclusion. But if you're finding the technology is satisfactory, that's fine.
Well, we do most of our business face-to-face.
Good.
In the 6 meetings per year, when we had the hearing that I was telling Representative Barker about, after the hearing, they had a just like a jury deliberation. They all sat face-to-face. They hammered out what they wanted, and then the follow-up was by email.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much for presenting. I think our plan is to then come back and vote on this in the next
next Monday.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, next up, Mark Peterson, the Council on Court Procedures.
Good afternoon.
And if you all could both please identify yourself and feel free to begin when you're ready.
I'm Catherine Clark.
I'm Mark Peterson, Executive Director. Catherine Clark is going to do most of the speaking. She's a council member, the immediate past chair of the council, and was the council's representative to the work group, the legislative work group that deliberated on the role and future of the council.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, as Mr. Peterson told you, I'm an attorney in practice in Portland, and I've been on the Council on Court Procedures now for 8 years, since 1999. I was chair from 2005. When was I chair? 2003 to 2005, coinciding with the budget woes and the lack of funding, and I'm sure they have no causal relationship to each other. I'm going to start with a bit of background about the council. The council came into existence by statute, ORS 1.725, in approximately 1977. It was felt that it was best to move an overhaul of the rules of procedure for the courts to a council that consisted of attorneys and judges who used the rules. And there was a major overhaul that was done that resulted in the Oregon Rules of Procedure that we now have, and they were promulgated and accepted by the legislature with some modification in 1980. Since then, the council has been charged with reviewing those rules biennially, I cannot say that word accurately, and reporting to the legislature, suggesting amendments where appropriate, and has also been charged with consulting with the legislature at the legislature's request during the session when measures come up, as they have been known to do, that suggest further modifications to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, so that we have a legislative committee charged with the job of consulting with the legislature when requested. The council consists of 23 members, one justice of the Supreme Court, appointed by the Chief Justice, one judge of the Court of Appeals, 12 attorneys, eight trial court judges, 12 attorneys in private practice, and they are appointed by the bar. They are customarily divided roughly. Six from the plaintiff's bar, six from the defense bar, and I say roughly because they're also divided or allocated according to geographical distribution so that we get some diversity in terms of geography and in terms of practice area, so that we have somebody there currently, for example, whose expertise is probate, and that doesn't fit well within plaintiff's or defendant's bar. So that... But roughly, the idea is to keep it sort of balanced so that there is less of an opportunity for axe grinding, I would have to say. And that's, of course, also avoided by virtue of the fact that there's a strong contingent of the judicial branch on the council. There's also one public member that's appointed by the Chief Justice. The council meets primarily in the interim between sessions of the legislature. Meets approximately monthly. We don't have meetings in July and August because of scheduling difficulties. We put out the rules for notice and comment in September and then have our final meeting in December before the session to promulgate our rule changes. We have an executive director. Professor Peterson is currently the executive director and clerical support. The executive director has traditionally been from the University of Oregon, but as I will get to in a minute, in 2005, Professor Holland from the University of Oregon elected to retire, and the University of Oregon, faced with its own budgetary difficulties, said they could no longer support the council's work, which they had been doing since we had lost our budget allocation in 2003. So basically, I've jumped ahead a little bit. In 2003, we were not funded. We were given special permission to continue operating without any funds. We did have $8,000 contributed by the Oregon State Bar. They do this every 2 years for travel expenses, and that's primarily, in fact, during that time, it became exclusively for judicial travel expenses. We do have judges who are traveling from the other side of the mountains and from southern Oregon. Professor Holland, during that 2003-2005 period, donated his time without compensation. Clerical services, which had been provided by his assistant, were donated without compensation. It's my understanding, quite frankly, that Professor Holland defrayed some of those expenses out of his own pocket in order to offset some of her time. The $8,000, of course, was there for travel expenses. In 2005, the legislature allocated $10,000 to help with the expenses of the work group and other expenses associated with the council, so we had a little bit more leeway. But basically, we've been we also went to to several law schools, hunting for somebody who could give us assistance and support in terms of the executive director and clerical support, and Lewis and Clark agreed to do so. We are currently in the process of drafting a formal agreement between Lewis and Clark and the council that will set out the roles and responsibilities of the executive director in a more formal manner than has been done. In 2005 as well, there was a budget note establishing a work group to evaluate the council. That report has been submitted. It was extremely positive. It was done after a 50-state review of how other states draft and promulgate their rules of civil procedure. There's a lot of varieties on that theme, but a number of states do what we do, which is it's a hybrid group. That certain members of the bar are represented, the judicial branch is represented, and the legislature, of course, has the final say. So that there's a kind of commissioner council in many of the states that functions roughly the same as we do here. And the work group urged the support of the council by return of general fund support. Our current budget request is before you. I'm going to break it down in terms of what drives that budget. 75% to 80% of the budget is for the salary and related costs of the executive director and clerical support. 15% to 20% is for clerical supplies, phone services, associated costs. Let me back up for a moment. The Oregon State Bar also gives us meeting space. And when we do go occasionally, we have gone downstate. We meet at the University of Oregon. That also is donated. So meeting space is not a concern that is reflected in the budget that's been provided by the Oregon State Bar and the University of Oregon. And the balance is essentially travel expenses. We have been working to draft and prepare performance measures. This is a little bit difficult. You can't judge the work of the council exclusively by the number of rule changes that are proposed, because sometimes our work is in not changing the rules after looking at proposals that have come to us from lawyers or from other groups. For example, the Chief Justice has set up a task force for electronic filing of documents to evaluate that. And there was a proposal made to change certain rules of civil procedure, getting ready for an eventual change to the use of electronic filing of documents. And we became involved to consult with the e-filing task force. Some of the suggestions that were made, they simply hadn't thought of the impact in terms of, for example, service of summons and complaint, and the fact that that would have constitutional issues that would arise. So in consultation with the filing task force, we were able to make suggestions as to what changes might be necessary to smooth the way for e-filing of documents. But the performance measures, we are working on trying to develop a means of assessing our success in communicating with the elements of the bar and the public. One thing I did forget to mention, during the summer, one of the things that has happened is that we've already looked at rule changes, and we often have committee work that proceeds. It's very difficult to get the entire council together because of vacation schedules, but the committees proceeded to continue to work in preparation for the September meeting, which tentatively makes adopts the rules. And there's really only one priority that the council has, and that's to draft rules, make suggestions for their change that are workable within the court system and serve the public so that the courts are accessible and get the court's work done in an efficient way. Thank you.
Questions? So I'm trying to find in here, and you'll have to be patient with me because I'm new to the Ways and Means process, but the breakdown of where that $100,000 will go.
I had the same question. Oh, sorry. Chair Shields and members of the committee. I had the same question, and I found it here at one point, and then I lost it again.
The budget note does the breakdown by percentage.
Maybe page 22, budget page 22.
There was a note that gave it by percentages that I'm hunting for.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, which part are you looking for?
Just the breakdown of the money that we spent.
I think it's pages 11 and 12. Okay. And page 10. 10, 11, and 12. Page 10 gives the percentages that I was talking about. Restored funding would enable the council to reinstate the 0.21 FTE executive director position. That's FTE percentages. And I'm not budget percent. I was concerned with the same question, and I know we found that. The 75 to 80% is the combination of salaries, and approximately 20%, 15 to... Oh, it's the LFO note. Is that what? Yes. Which is page 49, is that?
Well, the one thing I was going to suggest is on the LFO analysis on 489 under governor's budget, it talks about the increase, and 70% of the budget is for personnel services, which is 23%. Well, it says personal services, but I could be wrong. It might be personnel services. But 23% for services and supplies.
Okay.
Which leaves some of the remainder over. If you look at budget page 11, it shows the per diem and mileage and so on. But if I might follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Mr. Borden, I'm wondering what the difference is between the LFO's 123,646 total funds budget and the Orbit's budget of 118-something.
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, one thing we have going on here is that the council has, as a base budget, the $10,000 with some adjustments for inflation and state government service charges, plus the continuation of the $8,000 from the Oregon State Bar.
Okay.
And then on top of that, they're seeking the refunding of the executive director position for 0.21 FTE and a 0.5 support position in policy package 100. So the combination of those items produces the $123,464. So when we look on page 10, for example, that's just the policy package 100, general fund request of the council for $102,812.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So it's the $102,812 plus the $10 that the legislature had given up already. That puts it as $112,000. What was the next number? The $8,000 from the bar. That puts us at $120,000.
Then I think another couple of thousand in incidental expenses.
Yes. If you're familiar with Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, if you're familiar with the essential budget level, which is the $18,000 that they had before, with some minor adjustments for inflation and the DAS charges. That would bring their budget to $20,834. And then from there we add a policy package for the $102,812 to arrive at $123,464 total funds. And of that amount, $115,464 is general fund and $8,000 other funds.
So where can we find, excuse me, Mr. Chair, where can we find that? What page? I don't see the higher number on page 11. Where can we find it totaled out like that with the expenditure limitation and the existing package and the package 100? Where can we find them all in one place? Well,
page 22 seems to be a listing of package 100.
And if you follow through to page 25, you finally get to the 123,646.
Thank you.
It ends on 25.
Got it. Thank you very much.
So the bulk of the request is going to fund staff.
Yes, correct, Chairman. That's correct.
Yes, that's page 13.
Or massages.
Yeah, Senator Brennan.
First of all, I want to really thank you for the work you do. You're all volunteers. You've operated all this time with Dean Holland retiring without a budget. You've cobbled together. We did our part. We contributed a little bit of Bill Taylor's time, but you're basically volunteers coming from all over the state doing very complicated work that, in my view, nobody else could do, and I wanted to commend you for that and hope that we can start to move toward making you whole again. I did have a question because of an issue that came up last year in the Judiciary Committee regarding class action lawsuits and what happens to the unclaimed balance, et cetera. And the Council of Court Procedures kind of dealt with that issue, and I wasn't at those meetings, but it dealt with an issue in a way that caused some controversy among some and some, in my humble view, not well-thought-out statements. But it also raised the issue of the decision-making in the council. I mean, there's a nexus between the council and the legislature, and I just wanted to get from you what your understanding is. You work on the rules, and then the legislature, does the legislature have to ratify them, or does it do they go into effect absent some legislative action?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick. They do go into effect automatically unless the legislature takes action. I can speak briefly to the class action bill and what happened with that. Yes. The council did take action this time to modify the class action bill. And it had to do not with the unclaimed funds so much as with the notice of claim procedures and giving more discretion to the court as to when a particular notice of claim procedure was required. The unclaimed funds issue crosses a line that the statute recognizes and the council responds to between substance and procedure. And it was felt that if there was to be unclaimed fund, disposition of unclaimed funds by Cypre Recovery, which I barely understand. This is not my area of the law, and I have to rely on other council members every time to explain it to me. But Cypre Recovery for unclaimed funds or allocation of unclaimed funds to other recipients of that sort requires a substantive decision, a substantive legal decision that we felt, the council felt, was beyond the council's concern. It was more than a procedural shift. It was something that the legislature should make a determination on.
But to follow up, Mr. Chair, so what you did was the council made some changes in the notice requirement and left it to the legislature to deal with the policy issues. Because I had sent a letter early on kind of asking for clarification. Did the decision on, did you have a record or any kind of communication to basically officially punt it back to the legislature, or did you just leave it and rely on us to kind of pick up the ball?
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, I think we did respond by letter, and I don't recall the details of that letter, but and I, perhaps Chris Peterson does, but we, in terms of directly saying to the legislature, we think you should act on this. No, we did not do that. We simply made certain rule changes, and they were worked out at least in the at the beginning. It was a compromise between business interests on the one hand and litigators on the other, as to when a notice of claim should be required and when it should not, and what kind of discretion should be vested in the court. And that might or could conceivably have some impact on the question that's raised by Cypre Recovery. But we just simply left that for interested parties to bring to the legislature if they felt it necessary.
I appreciate that, and I thank you for the committee's indulgence. These are the perils of having the Judiciary Chair on the, on the Budget Committee.
Just about ready to say this would be a good discussion for the Policy Committee.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Well, I thought you gave a very good explanation of a subject matter she's not familiar with.
Sure. I'll fight you back.
Yeah, well, we will anticipate doing a work session on this next week. And thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we don't have anybody who wants to comment publicly on either of those budgets. Is that correct? That's the case. Well, this meeting is adjourned.